just his scrotum? The officer nodded proudly. Yes, when the church obtains the remains of a great man, they saint him and spread the relics to different cathedrals so everyone can enjoy their splendor. And you got the... Becker stifled a laugh. Oye, it's a pretty important part, the officer defended. It's not like we got a rib or a knuckle like those churches in Galicia. You should really stay and see it. Becker nodded politely. Maybe I'll drop in on my way out of town. Mala suerte, the officer sighed. Bad luck. The cathedral's closed till sunrise mass. Another time, then, Becker smiled, hoisting the box. I should probably get going. My flight's waiting. He made a final glance around the room. You want a ride to the airport? The officer asked. I've got a Moto Guzzi out front. No, thanks. I'll catch a cab. Becker had driven a motorcycle once in college and nearly killed himself on it. He had no intention of getting on one again, regardless of who was driving. Whatever you say, the officer said, heading for the door. I'll get the lights. Becker tucked the box under his arm. Have I got everything? He took a last look at the body on the table. The figure was stark naked, face up under fluorescent lights, clearly hiding nothing. Becker found his eyes drawn again to the strangely deformed hands. He gazed a minute, focusing more intently. The officer killed the lights, and the room went dark. Hold on, Becker said. Turn those back on. The lights flickered back on. Becker set his box on the floor and walked over to the corpse. He leaned down and squinted at the man's left hand. The officer followed Becker's gaze. Pretty ugly, huh? But the deformity was not what had caught Becker's eye. He'd seen something else. He turned to the officer. You're sure everything's in this box? The officer nodded. Yeah, that's it. Becker stood for a moment with his hands on his hips. Then he picked up the box, carried it back over to the counter, and dumped it out. Carefully, piece by piece, he shook out the clothing. Then he emptied the shoes and tapped them as if trying to remove a pebble. After going over everything a second time, he stepped back and frowned. Problem? Asked the lieutenant. Yeah, Becker said. We're missing something. Chapter 13. Tokugen Numataka stood in his plush penthouse office and gazed out at the Tokyo skyline. His employees and competitors knew him as a Kutasame, the deadly shark. For 3 decades, he'd outguessed, outbid, and out-advertised all the Japanese competition. Now he was on the brink of becoming a giant in the world market as well. He was about to close the biggest deal of his life, a deal that would make his Numatech Corp the Microsoft of the future. His blood was alive with the cool rush of adrenaline. Business was war, and war was exciting. Although Tokugen Numataka had been suspicious when the call had come 3 days ago, he now knew the truth. He was blessed with Mayuri, good fortune. The gods had chosen him. I have a copy of the Digital Fortress passkey, the American accent had said. Would you like to buy it? Numataka had almost laughed out loud. He knew it was a ploy. Numatech Corp had bid generously for Ensai Tankado's new algorithm, and now one of Numatech's competitors was playing games, trying to find out the amount of the bid. You have the passkey? Numataka feigned interest. I do. My name is North Dakota. Numataka stifled a laugh. Everyone knew about North Dakota. Tankado had told the press about his secret partner. It had been a wise move on Tankado's part to have a partner. Even in Japan, business practices had become dishonorable. Ensai Tankado was not safe, but one false move by an overeager firm and the passkey would be published. Every software firm on the market would suffer. Numataka took a long pull on his umami cigar and played along with the caller's pathetic charade. So, you're selling your passkey? Interesting. How does Ensai Tankado feel about this? I have no allegiance to Mr. Tankado. Mr. Tankado was foolish to trust me. The passkey is worth hundreds of times what he is paying me to handle it for him. I'm sorry, Numataka said. Your passkey alone is worth nothing to me. When Tankado finds out what you've done, he will simply publish his copy, and the market will be flooded.
You will receive both pass keys, the voice said. Mr. Tankato's and mine.
Numataka covered the receiver and laughed aloud. He couldn't help asking,
How much are you asking for both keys?
$20 million.
20 million was almost exactly what Numataka had bid.
20 million?
He gasped in mock horror.
That's outrageous.
I've seen the algorithm. I assure you, it's well worth it.
No shit, thought Numataka. It's worth 10 times that.
Unfortunately, he said, tiring of the game, we both know Mr. Tankato would never stand for this. Think of the legal repercussions.
The caller paused ominously.
What if Mr. Tankato were no longer a factor?
Numataka wanted to laugh, but he noted an odd determination in the voice.
If Tankato were no longer a factor?
Numataka considered it.
Then you and I would have a deal.
I'll be in touch, the voice said.
The line went dead. Chapter 14. Becker gazed down at the cadaver. Even hours after death, the Asian's face radiated with a pinkish glow of a recent sunburn. The rest of him was a pale yellow, all except the small area of purplish bruising directly over his heart. Probably from the CPR, Becker mused. Too bad it didn't work. He went back to studying the cadaver's hands. They were like nothing Becker had ever seen. Each hand had only 3 digits, and they were twisted and askew. The disfigurement, however, was not what Becker was looking at.
Well, I'll be, the lieutenant grunted from across the room. He's Japanese, not Chinese.
Becker looked up. The officer was thumbing through the dead man's passport.
I'd rather you didn't look at that, Becker requested.
Touch nothing, read nothing.
Ensai Tankato,
born January?
Please, Becker said politely. Put it back.
The officer stared at the passport a moment longer and then tossed it back on the pile.
This guy's got a Class 3 visa. He could have stayed here for years.
Becker poked at the victim's hand with a pen.
Maybe he lived here.
Nope. Date of entry was last week.
Maybe he was moving here, Becker offered curtly.
Yeah, maybe. Crummy first week, sunstroke and a heart attack.
Poor bastard.
Becker ignored the officer and studied the hand.
You're positive he wasn't wearing any jewelry when he died?
The officer looked up, startled.
Jewelry?
Yeah, take a look at this. The officer crossed the room. The skin on Tankato's left hand showed traces of sunburn, everywhere except a narrow band of flesh around the smallest finger. Becker pointed to the strip of pale flesh.
See how this isn't sunburned here?
Looks like he was wearing a ring. The officer seemed surprised.
A ring?
His voice sounded suddenly perplexed. He studied the corpse's finger. Then he flushed, sheepishly.
My God, he chuckled. This story was true?
Becker had a sudden sinking feeling.
I beg your pardon?
The officer shook his head in disbelief.
I would have mentioned it before, but I thought the guy was nuts.
Becker was not smiling.
What guy?
The guy who phoned in the emergency. Some Canadian tourist. Kept talking about a ring. Babbling in the worst damn Spanish I ever heard.
He said Mr. Tankato was wearing a ring?
The officer nodded. He pulled out a Ducato cigarette, eyed the no fumar sign, and lit up anyway.
Guess I should have said something, but the guy sounded totally loco.
Becker frowned. Strathmore's words echoed in his ears.
I want everything Ensai Tankato had with him. Everything. Leave nothing. Not even a tiny scrap of paper.
Where's the ring now? Becker asked.
The officer took a puff.
Long story.
Something told Becker this was not good news.
Tell me anyway.
Chapter 15. Susan Fletcher sat at her computer terminal inside Node 3. Node 3 was the cryptographer's private soundproof chamber just off the main floor.
A 2-inch sheet of curved one-way glass gave the cryptographers a panorama of the crypto floor, while prohibiting anyone else from seeing inside. At the back of the expansive Node 3 chamber, 12 terminals sat in a perfect circle. The annular arrangement was intended to encourage intellectual exchange between cryptographers, to remind them they were part of a larger team. Something like a Codebreaker's Knights of the Round Table. Ironically, secrets were frowned on inside Node 3. Nicknamed the Playpen, Node 3 had none of the sterile feel of the rest of crypto. It was designed to feel like home. Plush carpets, high-tech sound system, fully stocked fridge, kitchenette, a Nerf basketball hoop. The NSA had a philosophy about crypto. Don't drop a couple billion bucks into a code-breaking computer without enticing the best of the best to stick around and use it. Susan slipped out of her Salvatore Ferragamo flats and dug her stockinged toes into the thick pile carpet. Well-paid government employees were encouraged to refrain from lavish displays of personal wealth. It was usually no problem for Susan. She was perfectly happy with her modest duplex, Volvo sedan, and conservative wardrobe. But shoes were another matter. Even when Susan was in college, she'd budgeted for the best. "You can't jump for the stars if your feet hurt," her aunt had once told her. "And when you get where you're going, you darn well better look great." Susan allowed herself a luxurious stretch and then settled down to business. She pulled up her tracer and prepared to configure it. She glanced at the email address Strathmore had given her, ndakota@ara.anon.org. The man calling himself North Dakota had an anonymous account, but Susan knew it would not remain anonymous for long. The tracer would pass through ARA, get forwarded to North Dakota, and then send information back containing the man's real internet address. If all went well, it would locate North Dakota soon, and Strathmore could confiscate the passkey. That would leave only David. When he found Tancato's copy, both passkeys could be destroyed. Tancato's little time bomb would be harmless, a deadly explosive without a detonator. Susan double-checked the address on the sheet in front of her and entered the information in the correct data field. She chuckled that Strathmore had encountered difficulty sending the tracer himself. Apparently, he'd sent it twice, both times receiving Tancato's address back rather than North Dakota's. It was a simple mistake, Susan thought. Strathmore had probably interchanged the data fields, and the tracer had searched for the wrong account. Susan finished configuring her tracer and queued it for release. Then she hit return. The computer beeped once. Tracer sent. Now came the waiting game. Susan exhaled. She felt guilty for having been hard on the commander. If there was anyone qualified to handle this threat single-handed, it was Trevor Strathmore. He had an uncanny way of getting the best of all those who challenged him. 6 months ago, when the EFF broke a story that an NSA submarine was snooping underwater telephone cables, Strathmore calmly leaked a conflicting story that the submarine was actually illegally burying toxic waste. The EFF and the oceanic environmentalists spent so much time bickering over which version was true, the media eventually tired of the story and moved on. Every move Strathmore made was meticulously planned. He depended heavily on his computer when devising and revising his plans. Like many NSA employees, Strathmore used NSA-developed software called Brainstorm, a risk-free way to carry out what-if scenarios in the safety of a computer. Brainstorm was an artificial intelligence experiment described by its developers as a cause-and-effect simulator. It originally had been intended for use in political campaigns as a way to create real-time models of a given political environment. Fed by enormous amounts of data, the program created a relationary web, a hypothesized model of interaction between political variables, including current prominent figures, their staffs, their personal ties to each other, hot issues, individuals' motivations weighted by variables like sex, ethnicity, money, and power. The user could then enter any hypothetical event, and Brainstorm would predict the event's effect on the environment. Commander Strathmore worked religiously with Brainstorm, not for political purposes, but as a TFM device. Timeline, flowchart, and mapping software was a powerful tool for outlining complex strategies and predicting weaknesses. Susan suspected there were schemes hidden in Strathmore's computer that someday would change the world.
Yes, Susan thought. I was too hard on him.
Her thoughts were jarred by the hiss of the Node 3 doors. Strathmore burst in.
Susan, he said, David just called. There's been a setback.